Hello listeners and welcome to the brand new Cloud Choice podcast. We've got a lot to come over the next few months. We're going to be covering everything cloud native. So starting with today, and this is, you know, it's a great moment. It's our first inaugural podcast on the state of the current market. We have a fantastic interview by the cloud native king himself, Mr. Matt Stein. I'm your host, Dan O'Riordan. I'm a cloud native architect working at Capgemini. I focus a lot in the financial services industries. My co-host for this season is here with me as well. It is great to kick off and great to introduce the lovely Lisa Hirsch. Lisa, how are you doing?
Well, hey Dan, thank you for that intro. So my name's Lisa Hirsch. I'm out of New York City. I also am a cloud native architect with Capgemini. And I'm just elated at the opportunity to spend some time with you today and tell you a little bit about our research, about some news that we will cover out today, as well as a great interview with Matt Stein, who some people say is the grandfather of cloud native, but we know he's very young at heart and actually a young guy in person, right, Dan?
Yeah, I think he's definitely younger than me, Lisa. So I'm not sure about you, but he's definitely younger than me. You know, so that really is it's a great interview. So it's worth a listen. So this week I'm in the lovely city of Utrecht, and I'm working with one of the big banks up in Holland, and I'm working on their cloud strategy. Really, really interesting. You know, they're looking at cloud native. You know, they're looking at aggressively moving to the cloud. They're looking at the way they do delivery pipelines. So it's a fantastic project to be involved in. You know, it's a great privilege, you know, to be involved in, you know, what really is quite a traditional industry, you know, banking, and the fact that, you know, they're looking to aggressively move to not just private cloud but also to public cloud. So that's what's keeping me awake at night, Lisa.
Well, it sounds like you're tiptoeing through the tulips over there in Holland. Is that correct?
very good. That's it exactly. And what about you? What have you been up to this week, Lisa?
Well, I just got back from India, where, you know, went out and had some time with our folks out in Mumbai as well as in Bangalore, and we, you know, kind of went over cloud native, our migration factories we have out there, as well as our cloud managed services where we have our PaaS management out in India. So it was quite an amazing trip, fast at that, but I'm back in the big city and ready to go.
Okay, Lisa, shall we chat about what we're doing here today?
Absolutely. Dan, why don't you give them a great spin on what we're going to be talking about today?
Okay, this is the great spin. So our new research shows that businesses are set to more than double the amount of cloud native development they do by 2020, and that this will drive massive business disruption as the leaders outpace the laggards. In these series of Cloud Choice podcasts, we're going to be talking about why the cloud native revolution is happening, what it all means, and what businesses can do about it. Lisa?
Well, you know, as I mentioned before, we've got some guests today. We've got news. We've got different topics to discuss with you about our research at Capgemini that's recently been published. And shall we kick off the day? I wanted to get your feedback and your thoughts about what seems to be top of the mind lately, or just recently with everyone, and that is that NHS attack. I read an article in the Telegraph that was written by Henry Buttock, and it seemed to be very interesting about how intense it was, one, how it affected the world, and how the you know, the hospitals came to bear with this ransom attack. What's your view on that?
I was reading that as well. It was basically the NHS bosses and the government, they faced some serious questions, you know, over why hospitals, you know, why they were left vulnerable to such a global cyber attack that crippled their services. You know, but I do, in a way, I do sympathize with them, because, you know, the world is changing so quickly. cloud migration is happening so quickly. But in one way, I actually think cloud will probably help, because probably a lot of these attacks happen through human error, through maybe lack of funding to apply all of the security patches. You know, so I think cloud, even though a lot of people talk about cloud and the security challenges around cloud, I think it will actually help to prevent probably in the future these types of attacks.
Yeah, you know, Dan, that's funny you should say that, because I'm of the same thought process. I mean, cloud, I think, will enable many to give them the thought that we need to make a change. We need to make a change in our infrastructure. We need to update our legacy systems. Because, you know, in that article I read, you know, how some of the hospitals were working off of, 2003 Windows, which, you know, simply aren't supported anymore.
Yeah, no, it's you know, I mean, it's down to the amount of manpower and resources, you know. So there's another article I want to talk about, if you've actually read it, talking about how, it was a report from IDC, how global cloud IT infrastructure spend that is going to hit $2.6 billion in 2016. Did you have a look at? Did you have a chance to look at that article?
You know, I did, and it's not surprising to me, because the service providers are growing at such leaps and bounds that the spend is really getting large in that construct, as well as many of the private cloud scenario for many is causing a revamp of the servers, of the databases, etc., so that they're suitable to handle the new workloads and the new way of cloud.
It doesn't surprise me, but as I always call myself, a plumber. So maybe I've been working in this industry so long. And I've been working in cloud for the last, 10 years. So it doesn't surprise me, but it does surprise me how some of the traditional financial services industries, because I work in financial services quite a lot, how they're basically they're adopting to it and they're jumping onto it.
Yeah. So Dan, did you get a chance? There's another article that I found to be quite interesting, and it really ties in to our cloud native research, and that is the article from cloud computing about CIOs are getting the cloud message.
Poor CIOs. I mean the role of the CIO is really changing. Traditionally, when I used to think of a CIO, I used to think of the person responsible for keeping the lights on the private data center for an organization. But I think now the role of the CIO is changing, and they're being looked at more as being, involved in the whole business strategy of an organization. So I think one of the challenges probably is how did the CIOs, how did they reskill? Do they need to reskill? Has the profile of a CIO changed? If I was running an organization, what do I look for in a new CIO? So, I think these are very, very interesting questions. So let's move on to, what are we going to move on to?
Well, I think what I'd like to try to delve into is, the topic of state of the market.
Good point. Well, especially as this podcast is about state of the market, we should probably talk about it, Lisa. So what is the state of the market? Talk to me a little bit about this cloud native. Imagine I've just tuned into this podcast and it's the first time I've heard the term. Can you give a simple description of it? I know sometimes you like to get technical, Lisa, but is there a kind of a simple statement I could say to my mother if she was listening into the podcast? No, and no offense to mothers out there, but is there a simple explanation we could give?
Yeah, to me, the simplest way of placing it is that cloud-native applications were born to live on the cloud.
Well, I suppose if we look at the cloud, you know, traditionally public cloud is built on commodity hardware. So I think, you know, the way applications were developed in the past, some of the parts of the architecture of an application were designed around specific hardware. If we look at the way a database was designed, you know, be it running on Oracle or DB2, you know, the hardware, the infrastructure, the way the applications were architected were specific to that database functionality. And with commodity hardware, you know, it became necessary to maybe to re-architect the applications that would actually make use of that infinite scalability that cloud offers, but also takes into account that because it's built on commodity hardware, you know, different parts can break. So how do you build in that resiliency, you know, into your architectures? So that for me is what cloud native is. It's really building, designing, architecting applications that run on commodity public cloud.
That's a great way of thinking about it, Dan. That's a great way of thinking about it. I mean, you know, we've been doing some enormous research within Capgemini, right? And based on the survey that we've done, it's over, you know, about 900 executives in 11 different countries. We're showing right now that there's a small number of companies that are adopting cloud-native applications, and that their mindset is definitely shifting in that direction to develop these applications and move from that monolithic application way of life. So what's your perspective on that?
Well, I mean, yeah, I've been looking through the report quite a bit recently, and only 1/6, that's 15% of the respondents firms, that new applications, you know, so new applications are being built in a cloud-native environment. But judging by their intentions, I think that this figure will more than double to 32% in the next 3 years. And one of the key drivers for this is the desire to improve agility, and we talk about business agility, and also scalability, but also not forgetting to increase velocity, and therefore, you know, thereby reducing time to market. And I think that's one of the key things about cloud native. All businesses are looking for that extra edge over over the competition. And if you can introduce, you know, small, medium, and large change to the way your business operates, then you have a potential to outbe, you know, to be more competitive than your competitors. So is that one of the key things?
Well, yes, that's this week's news seems to be saying it quite well. You know, I also think that leaders are registering tangible gains from moving to cloud native. The research also indicates that they're deploying applications faster than others, and further ahead in monetizing their application program interfaces. This impacts the bottom line, right? And 8 out of 10, 84%, say that they are increasing their revenue and and reducing their operating costs as a result of this. Now, almost 83% say they're moving ahead of their peers in a financial performance perspective by making that leap to a cloud native.
Absolutely, and as we all know, Lisa, it's all about the bottom line, you know. So, but one of the things also this report talks about is the, you know, the skills and cultural change, and what a big and a tough challenge that is. You know, I was just kind of reading that, you know, between the legacy infrastructure and the vendor lock-in, you know, these are obstacles, but that the most formidable barriers, they involve people and culture. And when asked to, you know, to compare several types of challenges, skills emerge as the most significant, and this was cited by 70% of the executives. But also sometimes cultural issues followed closely behind, also then followed by cost and technology issues. And the cost and technology issues, which would you would have imagined would have been, you know, a more significant problem, you know, they were deemed to be of a lesser difficulty. You know, I thought that was quite interesting.
Well, you know, and to that point, the cultural change, I mean, I think that that really stems from going from a waterfall type approach of cloud native application development into a DevOps world where we're doing very small iterations and utilizing those microservices to stitch together applications very quickly. And that mindset culturally has not been most, you know, adopted by many of the people that are so used to that waterfall approach. Is that's my perspective from a cultural aspect.
Yeah, no, I see that quite a bit. Something else, and I'd like to talk about as well, is just to discuss, you know, how different industries and how they're at different levels. You know, I think some of the retail and maybe some of the telecommunication sectors, you know, they've probably are more advanced in this cloud native implementation. I know financial services are beginning to look at it and beginning to approach it. But it's interesting the way different industries and how they're at different levels, and it's, you know, how we can, you know, help them to move to, you know, a more advanced level in this.
You know, I guess to that point, we will certainly find out soon enough as statistics continue to roll in and we continue to track this, you know, on a month-to-month and quarterly basis.
Yeah, and this series of podcasts, we'll be, you know, we'll be, I mean, feeding back and letting our listeners know, you know, what's happening, because this is, you know, all of this is changing really, really quickly. So, you know, any insights, any little nuggets, Lisa, you get, because I know you're there at the coalface. If you can maybe feed back to the listeners, I mean, that would be great.
No, absolutely. I think that's what this is all about, is informing and providing information as quickly as possible as we go through this cloud journey and we make this paradigm shift in how we do software development.
So it's my great pleasure to introduce Principal Architect at Pivotal, Matt Stein. So Matt, he is a 17-year veteran of the enterprise IT industry. 8 of those years he spent as a consulting solutions architect for various Fortune 500 companies, as well as the not-for-profit St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. He is the author of a fantastic book. Really, it is a must-read, Migrating to Cloud-Native Application Architectures from O'Reilly. And he's also the host of the Software Architecture Radio Podcast. Your book, I mean, your book for me has been inspirational. You know, Migrating to Cloud-Native Application Architectures, I use it. But in it, you've mentioned that this cloud-native approach with the advent of the iPhone, which it's having its 10-year anniversary, and that was something that really made, you know, businesses rethink how they actually develop their applications. Can you go into a little bit of detail on that, Matt?
Yeah, sure. I keep thinking that I can be done telling this story, but I keep retelling it because it really, the more I watch what we're doing today and the more I compare it to what we were doing pre-2007, the more I realize that was the inflection point in this whole business. And I think really what it boils down to is the ubiquitous access to computing. Before 2007, everybody was walking around with phones. People made phone calls on phones. People, you know, the texting had not become quite the way of life that it is now, but it had become normal. But nobody actually thought of the device that they had in their pocket or in their purse as a computer. People thought of computers as devices that were large, heavyweight, sat on desks. Even laptops were, 10 years ago, not terribly pleasant to carry around. And to say nothing of tablets were something that you saw on Star Trek for the most part. We didn't really. Although I recently rewatched 2001, and it's amazing how well they nailed the iPad in that movie. What is that? 50 some odd years ago. So I don't know. Remember exactly what year it came out, but it's been a long time. And so now we're walking around with more computing power on our person than we sent astronauts to the moon with. And everybody has that. And Apple did something very interesting, which was to enable people to do that without thinking that they were using a computer. I mean, we've made mobile devices that were very powerful for quite some time, but you really needed to be, you know, an expert level in technology to get anything out of them from a utility perspective. And now, you know, I watched, you know, my children were, you know, born and being born around this time. And I watched them before I ever taught them how to use one of these devices, quite happily using one of these devices and doing things sometimes that I didn't even know that you could do on it. So it's very intuitive, right? And so now there's this device that everybody now has, but was starting to be able to acquire, and it's really easy to use. And a few businesses noticed that, oh, this is an interesting new portal. This is a new interesting way that I can interact and do business with people. And people started, you know, as the App Store became a real thing, and people figured out what we could actually do with that, creating these very customized, customer-centric channels to do very specific types of interactions that had been done differently up until that point. Usually required me to do business with some middle layer in the interaction. You know, I tell the story a lot of going to the bank to check your balance, or making a phone call to check your balance, or going to an ATM, or logging into a website from a computer sitting on a desk. And now, you know, anytime, anywhere, I can check my bank balance as often as I like. And that changed the scale demands on the software that these banks were running behind the scenes to actually make that transaction happen. And there was a natural governor to how much load you could put on those architectures, because again, you had an X number of people in a call center. You could regulate how many ATMs were able to make inquiries. You could make that very, and just the number of people who were actually going to try to do that at any point in time was low. Things had to be open for business. Now I can, if I just really want to, I can wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and check my bank balance on my phone, and lo and behold, it works. They don't have to be open for that to happen. And so you take that, multiply at times all of these business interactions that used to require a decent amount of middle infrastructure in terms of people who were doing this work for us. And now not only do you not have to interact with a human being, but you're able to do that again anytime, anywhere that you have connectivity, then that times all of those businesses, the scale demands have rapidly increased beyond anything that most IT organizations were ever equipped to deal with.
So you know, I get it from a user point of view.
Sure.
But when you and you know, I deal a lot with financial services, banks and insurance companies, and I'm finding that they understand that they need to go in a certain direction in a cloud native way, but the big challenges they face are they have these mainframe systems or these legacy systems that were designed in the 1970s. They still need to keep the lights on. So how do you what messaging or how do you have a conversation with the guys who have these systems, these monolithic systems, and how do you actually convince them, or do they need convincing to move to this new way of thinking?
I've been trying to do agile transformation type work from very early on in my career, just because I saw the value in what we could do if we stopped wasting time on a lot of the processes that we had, and move to a more agile way of working. And it was very difficult to convince anybody of the value, especially when, for instance, I'm working in a retail company who's managed to triple its stock price in the last few years without making any significant change to its IT investment or way of doing business. And, you know, the conversation, well, you could be doing so much better even than that if you make these changes, is a very difficult conversation to have. You quite often get the answer, well, we're doing quite well as we are, thanks. But when you start to get into the conversation of, you may not survive the next decade if you don't fundamentally change the way you're doing things. And a few years ago, that conversation was, well, all of these disruptors from Silicon Valley are coming to get you. But now the conversation has shifted to, and so have a lot of your peers. If you haven't decided to make these changes yet, many of your peers are. You know, 20% of the Fortune 100 now have decided, yeah, we're going to make this change. And that's just the ones that one person, one data point, am working with. But it's becoming clear that, okay, if you don't do this, your peers will. And if they get the kind of results that others have gotten, it's likely that they're going to be able to overcome you by several orders of magnitude in terms of how well they can do business. And it's going to become clear that, well, if I could do business with this company or you, and I have these great customer interactions built around software to my left, but when I look at you to my right, it feels like I'm still doing business. People throw around the phrase in the Stone Age. It still feels like that. Then it may be that I'm going to choose the company on the left. And if enough times that happens, all of a sudden companies can disappear. I mean, it happened quite slowly if you look at the history of, say, Blockbuster and Netflix. It felt like, to an unintentional observer, that overnight we went from there were all these brick and mortar stores that you drove to rent DVDs to people just don't do that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that is the Netflix story is a brilliant story. When I speak to some companies, so some companies are going down the containerization route. So they're looking at their architectures, they're looking at, you know, the domain-driven design and development, identifying a business context, and then wrapping that in a Docker-like container, and then using something like Kubernetes. Can you kind of go into details as to why maybe someone or an organization should look at maybe a platform offering?
I think that at this point, it's become pretty clear that for the next, I would say, decade or so, that's going to be my guess, that and the reason I say decade is that just thinking about the ability of organizations to dramatically change their IT infrastructure and re-architect systems is not something that they can do at the speed that these new things come out. We're in a situation now where there's still a whole lot of that vertical scale application server centric architecture out there, and people are moving to, say, platforms like Cloud Foundry, OpenShift for Red Hat, from Red Hat shows up in conversations, things that try to give a little bit more structure around the interaction with the underlying containerization system, but don't necessarily give you, here's a container orchestrator, here's a container image builder, go, right? You still need to build things on top of that to get from, okay, I can now run processes in containers and schedule them across a pool of computing resources, to I can think about continuous delivering, continuously delivering application services and ensuring that all of the things that they need to integrate with are just there and just work. So what Cloud Foundry does is to take that base level of infrastructure and add on top of that this next level of abstraction that allows me to even back away from thinking about scheduling software to run on compute nodes inside container images and trusting that that kind of stuff is going to happen and happen appropriately, but really focusing back on the value of we have this haiku that we throw around, you know, here is my code, run it in the cloud for me, I do not care how. And we really want to give development teams and application operations teams, DevOps teams, whatever you want to call it, we want to give them that capability to say, okay, coming back to your original formulation of the question, we want to take a business context and we want to build some software around that and deliver that as a technical capability of the organization.
So Matt, there's something really, really interesting in your book when you spoke about the KPIs, let's say, for the IT operations and then the KPIs for developers. So developers are basically hired to write code, to add business, to create new functionality, to come up with ideas. But IT operations, you know, they're responsible for making sure that these production systems, you know, keep running. And that we've set up all of these processes to actually to really check that when something goes into production, you know, that it's not going to break anything. So in your experience, how do you actually go through that organizational change? Because, you know, it is a massive organizational change. You know, taking these siloed organizations and then actually getting them to move in this, you know, this aggressive DevOps way.
Yeah, so I mean, once we've had the conversation and we've kind of come to an agreement that this is something that needs to happen, you now get to undertake the exercise of moving a very large object that's moving in a very specific direction and turning that. And if you look at, you know, how we have a large, say, ocean liner, and you compare the size of the rudder that can turn that ship, it's actually quite small by comparison. And so to think about this, you know, we could attempt to brute force move the entire organization in lockstep, and we're going to have very little success doing that because it's just not possible to move that many people and that many things that are moving at a specific velocity at the same time. I've seen it attempted. And it usually leads to a lot of frustration, chaos, and problems. But if we start small, so if we find a, you know, segment of the organization where we can show some obvious value by moving to a more agile way of working and continuous delivery and DevOps principles and cloud native architecture, making all of these things actually possible to do, then we can show success in a very small and specific place, and then we can start to use that as a seed to bring in additional teams. And so every success that I've seen has kind of started out that way.
You've spoken and you've mentioned that one of the big fears is this lock-in or vendor lock-in. So in your experience, I mean, do you see organizations looking at maybe one or two cloud, different cloud providers? Or can you go into a little bit of detail as to, is it an educational problem? Are these fears based on real facts?
Lock-in's a really interesting topic, because you're always locked into something. There's no such thing as I'm going to completely avoid lock-in. Even if you went and built every aspect of your architecture from the ground up, let's say you even went and built your own hardware. Everything you have, you own and you created. You are now very much locked into this thing that you've created, because the stuff that you build isn't going to work with anything else, right?
Feels like marriage mess, no?
Oh my. So you're locked into something, and it really just becomes a matter of looking at, you know, what you're going to be locked into as not I'm locked versus I'm not locked, but, you know, what is the cost of change in this particular segment of my architecture? And if my constraints move, whether slowly or quickly, you know, people will use the example of, okay, I've built all this stuff on top of one cloud provider, and then they come to me and say, okay, now your price is going to increase, you know, 3x. You know, how do I get out? And there are various ways to look at that, and this is not a new problem. So yeah, you're always locked into something.
Absolutely.
So you have to be very, you know, aware of that, and not think of it as sort of a binary equation, locked in or not locked in. It's okay. What is the cost of evolving this architecture from where I am to wherever I might want to go next year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years down the road, and being careful to design systems that allow me to have a manageable cost of change, since change is going to be the one thing that remains constant in your business.
Really interesting, you know. So in the next 5 years, the next 5 to 10 years, you're predicting pretty much, you know, most of the work we do will be changing our applications to this more cloud native. Are there some applications, you know, running on an enterprise that won't become cloud native in the next 5 to 10 years?
Oh, sure. So if you look at the complete software portfolio, there are kind of, you know, a few categories of things. There are things that, you know, we could get real obvious value out of moving this to a cloud native architecture and a cloud native way of, you know, delivering software now. So let's work on those things. Then there are some things where that, you know, that we're going to get maybe a little bit of value, maybe a little cost savings, but there's not going to be a real competitive advantage associated with moving this software. So maybe we move this eventually, or maybe when that cost equation, profit equation changes, then we move it. And then there are some systems like the, you know, these legacy, you know, say COBOL systems that nobody understands how it works anymore, but it seems to work and hasn't been touched in a while. The cost or risk of change is quite high, and so we should just leave those things as they are. And so all of the architectures that I've been working on over the last 2 years have all of these aspects to their portfolio, and so they're very hybrid in nature. We've got cloud native systems that are talking to and interacting with systems that are very obviously not cloud native, and there are patterns that we can use to ensure that, say, the legacy nastiness of those systems doesn't pollute this new cloud native software that we're building, and the opposite direction, you know, making sure that these cloud native systems that we're building don't overcome the ability of these legacy systems to scale and handle the load that's being placed on them. And everybody that I'm working with is in this kind of moving equilibrium between some amount of cloud native software and some amount of software that's very obviously not. And that's going to continue to evolve over time, because that cost and risk equation is going to continue to evolve over time.
Listen, it's been it's been fantastic to speak to you. As I said, that book you wrote was it's like a Bible I use when I'm speaking to my clients. So have you got a plan for a second book, Matt? Are you going to write a romantic novel maybe for your second book?
So something that I announced last week that still very early days, but I hope to see this get moving, is a community that I'm building around what I'm calling the Open Software Architecture Pattern Language. We have a domain, OSAPL, so OSAPL, .org. It doesn't mean anything, but it's at least pronounceable. And we have a Slack team that I started, and a GitHub organization. And I've managed to get a few people to join this community based on the keynote alone, but I'm going to be talking about this more and more over the course of the next year. And what I really want to do is kind of create this pattern language in the open and really start to document these modern cloud native architecture patterns in the open with a lot of practitioners, and then build that foundation. And then if I use that to turn it into a published book with a publisher, so somebody doesn't want to go sift through all of our GitHub repositories, but just wants kind of a curated, polished volume of that, then we may do that. There's a lot of precedent out there now for these so-called open source books that people end up buying from O'Reilly and Amazon anyway. So I think that the work that gets created will actually be much better than what I could go do if I locked myself in my room and wrote that next book by myself. So that's kind of the goal, which means that I don't have an announcement imminent around when that's going to be published. But it's certainly something that I'm really interested in.
That is really, really interesting. I've got to check that out. I wouldn't mind being involved. I think that's a really, really good idea. Because I think where a lot of organizations struggle is basically in identifying the patterns. So that whole educational part, learning from, as you very well described it, patterns, have evolved, and they come from experts and other people through experience. So it's basically a way of writing down experiences.
Yeah, it is.
Pretty much they're all the questions I have, Matt. Once again, thank you very much. It's been really, really informative. You're a leading light in this, and it's great to actually learn and to talk to somebody who's showing the way for people like myself. So thank you very much. So we've come to the end of our first podcast. How did you think it went, Lisa?
I'll tell you, I was just amazed at what we've covered, the opportunity to share some of our knowledge, some of our experiences, and some of our research, obviously, as well as some of Matt Stein's thoughts with our constituents out there to help them learn a little bit about cloud native going forward.
Yeah, he really is. He's an inspirational speaker. Matt is. It was a great interview. I mean, he gave us really such insight into what's happening at cloud native. So if the listeners if they want to ask us anything, if there's areas that they'd like us to go into more depth in, then you can tweet me. My name is Dan O'Riordan. It's at DanOrIordan. Lisa, any plans for this evening?
You know, Dan, I was going to ask you the same. I'm going to be very simple. I think I might have to go do a little spin class to keep my exercise up and keep my body going well for us, so that I can continue to help develop these cloud-native applications at the speed that we need to do so.
Yeah, you're making me feel guilty now, Lisa. I'm just going to crack open a beer. So I'll leave you this do the spinning, yeah? Okay, so thank you everyone for listening. I'm your host, Dan O'Riordan. It has been a great pleasure to do this first podcast with the lovely Lisa Hirsch. We hope to have you back here with us next time for a discussion around the CIO and the emerging role that the CIO has as the new business leader. And also, a fantastic interview with Mr. Paul Miller from Forrester. He is a very, very, very insightful guy, and he gives us some great insight as to what's happening with you know, the new role as we see it of the CIO. So thank you for listening.